Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast.
Where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
All right. Well, that's it for us today, everybody. We'll see. We were talking before about how we both feel a little bit inadequate here today. We're going to talk about the third part of Dante's Divine Comedy, Paradiso.
Yeah. I change translations almost every day. Goodness.
Yeah. And how different it is from the other two. You know, we're going to get into the ways, but I found it, especially at the beginning, a little bit difficult. Difficult in that, I don't know, it felt very different, and I guess it should have, from Purgatory and Inferno.
Yeah.
I'm going to be searching for words this entire podcast.
Well, I would say...
How do I describe him describing the ineffable?
Well, that's the problem you have, is he's using a lot of devices to describe something that's indescribable. And part of my problem I was realizing when I was thinking about it this morning is I miss Virgil.
Hmm.
Virgil's kind of, you know, we've gotten used to him over the last two books. And Beatrice is super... lady, you know, but she's also a heavenly soul now. And so she just doesn't relate to Dante in the way that Virgil does. I get that she describes everything and all this stuff, but I still missed our friendly guide. And part of the other problem is that, for me, is that we were kind of spoon-fed during Inferno and Purgatory, in that every new circle you came to, there was something new to look at. There was something happening. There was, even if it was just souls that were all bent over by a rock, you know, you heard encouragement and all this sort of thing coming from the air or saw it on the ground. Well, there are some things like that here, but there's a lot less because Dante has been purified. He doesn't need all that help, and he's still getting lessons as he goes that open his eyes to the light so he can see the light better and better as he's being prepared to see God at the end. But my eyes aren't as good as Dante's.
Oh, that's funny.
I'm a lesser soul. I like a little entertainment on the way.
Yeah, yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and there was so much description and theology and that kind of stuff in here. Yeah, for me, the difficulty was until the end, which I feel he nailed the ending.
he stuck the landing.
He stuck the landing, yeah. Trying to describe God to people is not a possible thing. There's nothing that we can say that would encompass everything that God is. And I think that, you know, here we are in Paradiso, and it's like whenever you write something down about what paradise would be, well, mm-hmm. you can think of something that it ought to be in addition to that, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a difference between something that is and the description of something. It's never the same thing.
Yeah, and he does his best. I mean, I'm sure he does magnificently. I myself just wasn't able to appreciate it fully. But I did like the way that he, on the way, was answering questions or having questions answered to him that were common objections. You know, for instance, what happens is that he and Beatrice are just ascending faster and faster and faster from heavenly sphere to heavenly sphere. And in the way of the medieval way of thinking, we know that the earth is at the center of the universe, but that's geographically speaking. Spiritually speaking, God is at the center of everything. And I found something. C.S. Lewis wrote this book that I really have got to get from the library, that he used to teach a class on medieval imagery. And the book that everybody asked him to write a book about it because they wanted to be able to go over it again, and it was called The Discarded Image. And one of the things he said is, we look at the stars and we think we're looking out. The medievals looked at the stars and they thought they were looking in. So we think of the way they thought about the Earth being the center of the universe as we're so important. But instead they were just going, it's like going, here's where the U.S. is. Here's where Britain is. It's just a location. Spiritually, they knew they had a long way to go. And so what Dante is doing that would have been real familiar to everybody from his time is they are starting to zoom closer and closer to God. And as they do that, in each sphere, you've got the moon, you know, you have Venus and Mars and Jupiter and all these various planetary, the sun,
mm-hmm.
all these things. He's meeting souls who kind of reflect what the medievals would have thought of as being inherent properties. So the moon is, they thought of silver and quicksilver, which is very changeable, and that allows him to talk to people who have been redeemed but who had changeable souls. They made a decision that was the wrong decision, but they made it through purgatory and here they are. And so one of the things that I really liked about that gets described early on is he's like, well, don't you guys feel bad? Because you're pretty far away from God. And they said, well, there's two things. One is you're seeing like an astral projection of us for your own benefit. We're all with God right now. This is for you. And then the next thing they say is each bit of creation, including us, has as much of his light as it can, as the capacity is capable. So, and the way, and that sounds like a cop-out, except that the description I read was from a commenter was that if you have a 6-ounce glass and an 8-ounce glass, when you fill the 6-ounce glass, if you keep going, it just spills out. That's as much as it can hold. The glass is perfectly happy with the 6 ounces. So,
right.
Yeah, I liked that.
Yeah, I like that very much
thinking
too.
Thinking about it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So those kind of descriptions I did like. It kind of made me feel better about my littleness. You know, we can't all be St. Thomas Aquinas.
And there was kind of a perspective thing going on here, too. You know, he's talking about these planets. And isn't there, you know, gosh, I'm not going to have this highlighted, but isn't there a point at which he's beholding the Earth while not being on it? Which was remarkable for, what is this, 1300-something again? I can't remember off the top of my head. Something like that. I have a, let's see. Yeah, right around 1300. A little bit after 1300. So, but to have that perspective where you can step away from the whole planet at a time... I mean, you know, we have the benefit mm-hmm. of having pictures from people who have left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and, you know, that was a profound moment in human history, the first picture like that we actually got. Really profound mm-hmm. moment. But, you know, again, it proves his genius. I don't know. Maybe there are writings, you know, there's no way I know if there's writings before this where somebody has written that down. But when I read that, I was really blown away by it.
Yeah, where he says the Earth is like a pebble, a tiny little pebble.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and because it is, and we have that perspective as modern people, but I don't know how many people in the medieval times had that perspective.
Well, and it's kind of our way to look back and think, oh, those simple, simple souls, you know, they were just progressing toward us, and really, then you look and go, oh.
Yeah,
they could imagine and think of things that are absolutely correct without having
absolutely.
To have a picture.
I remember the first time that I read like Plato's Apology long, long, long time ago. It was probably the oldest thing that I had read other than the Bible. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking, these people are just like us. And somehow in my head, you know, I was young enough that I was thinking that it would be different, just like you said, they're all simple and everything, and mm-hmm. and we are so awesome here in the modern times. Yeah. But it was like the same. I could picture us there.
Yeah.
And that was disheartening in a way to me. I remember.
Oh, really?
I remember the feeling. Yeah, I was like, we have not progressed at all in 3,000 years. And that, that's what I felt at the time. How do I feel right now? Some of the same, I think. Some of the same. It's like, you know, we live these lifetimes and we solve the same problems. And we're in this cyclical nature of history, it feels like.
Yeah, but maybe that's because we individually are on a different journey than we think about when we think about history.
Yeah, very possibly.
All acted the way we were supposed to act, we would be able to progress. But I think there's this problem of people thinking that societies evolve into something greater and people evolve into something greater, whereas each person is born at the very beginning, just like every other person throughout history.
Right, right. And that's an interesting perspective right there.
Yeah, that's kind of our problem. And that's why Dante is so good, because he's looking at politics at the same time. And, I kind of expected the politics to kind of lower. We don't need to talk about it so much. And instead what happens is the invective almost gets more personal and more fierce about politics and about the way maybe different orders in the church have corrupted or are not doing what the founders thought they should do. And I was reading something that said, it's because what Dante's trying to show us is the closer you get to God, the closer you judge everything based on his standards. And so, of course, you fiercely can deny everything that's not the way he wants it to be, or not right. When you have, which I thought was a great moment, wasn't it Thomas Aquinas who's praising the Franciscans, but he was a Dominican, and going, those Dominicans. Then you have, was it Bonaventure? No, who was it?
Boniface,
who
was I think.
Boniface.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, guys. I don't know why I got those names confused. I should have memorized them. But anyway, he is praising the Dominicans, and he was a Franciscan, and, you know, denouncing the Franciscan order as it is now. And so, of course, now only what you see is not only heavenly charity, because those two orders fought all the time. One was intellectual and teachers, Dominicans, and the others were the mendicants who went around and begged and – poverty.
That's right. It was interesting. Thomas Aquinas who told the story of St. Francis?
Yeah.
Right. That's really something. And then, Pope Francis, a Jesuit. Yeah. Remember when he took the name Francis and everybody was like, does he mean, which Francis does he mean? No, wait a minute.
Well, he does mean that one.
Yeah. That was neat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit of a similarity there. Another interesting thing about this to me was at first a negative, and then I suddenly got my eyes opened. So he's flying around up to the planets, and, you know, again, we know way more about the planets than Dante does. And and I was having trouble, you know, suspending disbelief, and it's like, okay, well, Jupiter is where the just are and all this stuff. And I'm like, no, Jupiter's a big gas giant planet and all this stuff. And then I think it was in, I did look this up. It was in Canto 28. Dante sees something in Canto 28. We're getting very near the end at that point.
Yeah.
And he basically asks, why am I seeing something that doesn't correspond to what I know is real? The notes say, puzzled, the pilgrim wishes to know why the visible order of the universe, the physical picture, does not conform to the order he is presently observing in the model before him, which is the ideal picture. And the answer really opened my eyes.
What was that answer?
The answer was basically you were seeing spiritual truth. You were seeing the spiritual way that the world operates, not the physical way that the world operates. And that just opened my eyes because to the whole thing. And it made some of my, you know, cynical objection, I guess, mm-hmm. or just a, you know, annoyance while you're flying around space. This is not how it works. You know, that's the silly yeah. stuff that I get. But, cause that is true. It's like, you know, when you argue with people that are atheists, you know, if they want to be atheists, there's no amount of arguing that's going to change their mind.
Yeah.
Because it seems as if there is no acceptance that there is anything else. That there is possibly another source of truth. There possibly is another realm of existence from which we can understand things. And it was a good reminder. It was something that was profound for me in reading it.
That's interesting. So you and Dante are kind of alike.
Are we? Well,
I don't know. Genius part, if he raised the objection, that means he thought of it.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
You know, that means he's like, well, what would people think? They're going to expect something realistic. And it's funny because I looked at it and I thought of, I just looked at it kind of in a science fiction sort of a way.
Mm-hmm.
So that when he got to the moon, I absolutely loved the reason for the dark spots on the moon. You know, they were like pools where the souls were that were going to come through and talk to him.
Yeah,
if I'm remembering that right.
Yeah, there was something like that, and I read that and I went, oh, that's interesting, but they're not.
Yeah, I just looked at it like, I've read so much science fiction about going out to other planets where we have no idea what's going on, and I don't demand that it be accurate.
Uh-huh.
Just reading it for the story at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's interesting that you were kind of cast into a, wait a minute, I know about this, because Dante would have had the same orientation in that way. I guess he was in hell, but no one knows what that's like, and that's the spiritual reality. He was in purgatory. Right. Again, no one knows what that's like, so that's the spiritual reality. Here he's intersecting with something everybody knows about.
Mm-hmm. So, and it might be the reason why fewer people read this. I don't know. I guess fewer people read Purgatory, too. They read Inferno and Stop, which is, you know, you have been vindicated. You know, it's exactly what you said. How could you skip these two? Because it makes the whole thing complete, and all I want to do is go start over.
Right?
Yeah, it's really, really something else.
I have to say, once I got it and the same thing happened to me again, it's kind of a transcendent experience after you finish it, because the end is truly glorious.
Hmm.
And it leaves you with images that are ineffable, but they are concrete enough for me that I can hold on to them. And then I'm always cast back, and he does this in the book a little. Toward the end, somebody says, now think back on where you started. And there's a little brief, remember Inferno, remember Purgatory. But I get to the end, and I'm suddenly thinking back, and maybe it's because he uses that star imagery at the end like he does in the first two. So you're reminded, and I think back on, you know, the hopeful souls in Purgatory, but then those angry and upset souls in Inferno, and I suddenly have a really clear perspective of how hellish it really was and what those souls denied themselves, all because they wouldn't give something up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, in that way, it's a magnificent work of, it accomplishes, I think, what it set out to do, even for somebody as limited as me in understanding a lot of it. I just look back and go, oh my gosh, that place is worse than I thought when you're first going through it, because we've been educated along with Dante all along the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if it struck you like that or not.
No, I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way, and that's, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking about it, but you're right. It, you know, Dante went through this journey really to prepare himself to see God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did all this stuff in preparation. It was, I'm having a hard time finding words. But the what you say seems to me to be so as well. But you started with the idea that these are spiritual truths that they're talking about in Inferno and Purgatory both, and then it's also the spiritual truth here. And how I, one of the benefits of this for me has been seeing things in that way, or being more open to that. Because, you know, you tend to say, well, things are as they are because of what you see. But, you know, even though I can say I believe in this other stuff, do I always act like it? You know, the answer is no, I do not. But this helps me with that.
Yeah, it gives you that. It gives you that idea of what you're shooting for. Yeah, and the perspective.
Yeah, it's perspective, you know? Changing. The whole experience has been perspective changing, I would say.
Good.
Yeah, in a very good way, I think.
Yeah, I have to say, the ending image is something where I never was able to understand, and I realize we're skipping over other stuff, but I was never able to understand the appeal of the way the Catholics put it is the beatific vision, the idea that in heaven you get to see God forever. And I'm just like, is there anything else to do there, you know? And yeah. But this vision that you get, there was one image that for me kind of set it in my heart and captured it for me, and that's do you mind if I go ahead and kind of describe?
Yeah.
Okay, so Dante gets up to it's called the Empyrean, if that's saying it right, but basically heaven. And his eyes aren't really adjusted. And it made me think of when you look at something and then you realize, whoa, I haven't been looking at that right at all. There's a face over there in that picture. But what he sees is a river of light between banks of flowers with sparks going back and forth between them. And then his eyes kind of go, oh, no, it's really just kind of like a lake of light. And he's like, oh, no, wait, these are flower petals. It's like a gigantic rose. And the souls are the petals seated around the center. The sparks are like bees on a flower. Those are angels going back and forth between the souls and the center and each other. And the center is God. So that's a wonderful image. And then half of it is, he of course has his hierarchical thing set up. Half of it is Old Testament saints. And so that's full.
Mm-hmm.
And then half of it is New Testament, and that's got empty spaces. Because, you know, maybe you and I can get a spot there, Scott. I'm hoping I got a seat reserved next to somebody. And so it's waiting for people. And but pretty full. You know, there's been a lot of time going on. And in the center is God. And at one point, he suddenly turns to Beatrice. He's going to say something, and she's back in her seat, and he's got a new guide. But he gives her this look of gratitude, and because they're with God, there's no sense of distance. They can see each other just like they were next to each other. And she gives him this loving, loving look, because he's got this internal prayer of thanks going on to her. And then she settles back in her seat and goes on looking at God. And there's something about the way he put it that just made it seem so satisfying, so interesting. That why would you ever look away, because this is the best thing ever. And to me, I suddenly went, okay, that's something I could strive for. I don't understand it, but I can accept it.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, did you experience, you said you kept bouncing around in translations.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a particular area in which you were looking at the others, or
no? By the time I got to the end, I was just really stuck with Anthony Asolin for most of it.
Okay,
and he's got a bit more. I don't know, something about the way he wrote was less formal, maybe a little less stiff to me.
Okay,
it was more accessible. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, and I stayed with the Musa the whole time.
Did you? Okay,
yeah, I never came out of that one. So,
yeah,
but yeah, it was an incredible image.
And by the end, it didn't matter which one I was reading. Mm-hmm. I liked, you know, I was back.
Well, it makes me want to try some other ones, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of different reasons. You know, it's like the Bible, right? So many translations of the Bible.
Yeah.
People taking different philosophies to the translation.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think as long as you get one that's not somebody's paraphrasing of it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying, where they just kind of went, I'm going to make it dynamic, and I don't think this part fits. I've read about people doing that with Beowulf or other things where it's like, well, that part was boring. I left it out. It's like, what?
Yeah.
To you, it was boring. Maybe it mattered.
Wow. Yep. Yeah, the very, I don't know if we want to go there already, but the very last few paragraphs are just, I just love it. I mean, I just, you know, this is pool room material right here.
The whole canto is, I read it three times. It was so amazing.
That's right.
So continue, please. Sorry.
Well, if I just look at the last piece, he says, as the geomire.
Geometer.
Geometer. Yeah. In mine, it's G-E-O-M-E-I-E-R.
Oh, in my Musa, it's geometer.
Maybe it's a typo.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, so as a geometer who tries so hard to square the circle but cannot discover, think as he may, the principle involved, so did I strive with this new mystery. I yearned to know how could our image fit into that circle, how could it conform, but my own wings could not take me so high. Then a great flash of understanding struck my mind, and suddenly its wish was granted. At this point, power failed high fantasy. But like a wheel in perfect balance turning, I felt my will and my desire impelled by the love that moves the sun and the other stars. Which, amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning there, I mean, who hasn't felt this, where you're just, you have a concept just at the edge of understanding, and you're trying to just finish it and trying to take the one more step needed. Because you can feel it. You can feel that it's there. This problem is almost solved, or this thing is just about understood. But yet, you can't quite get there. And then a flash of inspiration, and then you get there.
Yeah.
Could be, usually that happens in the morning.
Well, and you can't put it into words.
No, you can't. And it's wonderful how he does this. And he does this all over in all three books. Mm-hmm. There are moments like this that are just so incredibly true that it just blows me away.
Mm-hmm.
But that. And then at this point, power failed, high fantasy, but like a wheel in perfect balance turning, I felt my will and my desire impelled by the love that moves the sun and other stars. What that does for me, and I started to talk about it earlier, but it takes the physical universe and the spiritual universe and makes it one thing.
Yeah.
Because if you look at gravity, which is a desire of two things to be next to each other, really.
I guess that is so.
You know, it's almost right. Like, you know, when you say love that moves the sun and other stars, it suddenly becomes a poetic thing. And again, I'm going to have trouble describing what my feelings are, but there, it's just, all of a sudden, this physical universe has another dimension that I don't see all the time. And it's like a door open.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know,
because I can say, yeah, God created the universe, but what does it mean? And what does it mean spiritually, you know? And this somehow has made a connection there where suddenly now I'm seeing something, you know? Again, I can't quite describe it. I can't quite square the circle, but it's right on the edge, and I want to take that step so I can understand it.
Well, and that's that longing that then Dante has helped clarify a little bit, or just inspire you with, that God has used to kind of go, you're just a tiny bit closer, you know, and then you kind of want to go a little more. And so even when we forget that in our daily work and everything else, when we pick up Dante again or some other thing that reminds us of that, we can edge just a quarter of an inch closer.
Yeah.
And it's just the greatest feeling.
Right.
It's that, because it's that truth with a capital T, where you're just like, there is more than we can do because we can't put it into words.
Mm-hmm.
It's that ineffable, as you said.
Right. Amazing. Yep.
Well, and for me, one of the things that was, again, like you say, just on the edge of your understanding is, you know, there's the whole idea of the Trinity. And right before the part you read, he describes God. And he says, so he's looking at the living light at the center of the flower. And he says, yet, let's see, not that within the living light there was more than a soul aspect of the divine, which always is what it, capital I, has always been. Yet as I learned to see more and the power of vision grew in me, that single aspect, as I changed, seemed to me to change itself. Within its depthless clarity of substance, I saw the great light shine into three circles in three clear colors bound in one same space. The first seemed to reflect the next like rainbow on rainbow, and the third was like a flame equally breathed forth by the other two. How my weak words fall short of my conception, which is itself so far from what I saw that weak is much too weak a word to use. O light eternal, fixed in self alone, known only to yourself and knowing self, you love and glow, knowing and being known. That circling, which as I conceived it, shone in you as your own first reflected light when I had looked deep into it a while, seemed in itself and in its own self-color to be depicted with man's very image. My eyes were totally absorbed in it.
Mm.
And then he goes into the, you know, as as the geometer who tries to square the circle. And I was so taken by that way of expressing, using light as, you know, the giving of, and this, the oneness, but the threeness of the Trinity as one thing, and the way it kind of flows back and forth and breathed together and all this kind of thing. And especially that last glimpse of man's very image in itself and its own self-color. And a commentary I read said, humanity is not something extraneous to the light that is the sun, but rather it reveals the true nature of the sun. Here is the highest expression of love, the self-condescending love that sends Beatrice to aid a pilgrim lost in the dark wood, the terrifying love that constructed hell, the fiery love that keeps alive the flames of purgatory. Above all, it is the love of a God who did not think equality with God was something to be grasped, but humbled himself to take on the form of a servant. So the fact that there in heaven, the sun still is man, there's that image of man there, that's something that's intrinsic. It shows us something of God. And you're just like, mind blown.
Yeah.
But yet, as you're saying, enlightened a little more.
Right, right.
And it just made me love God a little bit more, you know?
Mm-hmm. Agreed. That's great.
That is from, by the way, it's a book called Ascent to Love, A Guide to Dante's Divine Comedy by Peter, I don't know how you say this, Leithart, Leithart.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Which is a good, simple guide.
Cool.
But,
yeah, are there any other books that you, have read along the way or been looking at?
Yeah, the two, which I think I mentioned last time, one's called Reading Dante by Giuseppe Mazzotti, mm-hmm. I think. And the other is Heaven and Hell. And that's looking at, I think it's from Homer or maybe even before Homer, at all the different ways that these classic pieces of literature have portrayed the afterlife.
Mm.
And that's by Luis Marcos.
Okay.
So,
yeah, the only other thing that I've been looking at or listening to actually is a teaching company course. Yeah, it's called Dante's Divine Comedy. It's from the teaching company. It's a course taught by William R. Cook and Ronald B. Hertzman. And I've listened to those as I've gone through the whole thing, sort of listening while I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. I liked it. There's 24 lectures. I thought so. yeah, it was neat. At the beginning, there's a lot of things about Dante, and then when it gets into the actual reading, you know, they went from, you know, sort of following the reading to sort of doing bigger concepts and things by the end.
And I listened to it when I, at the beginning of the year, began my, I'll read Dante again this year. Ha ha, this is my third time through. Wow. But I listened to it because I think you're the one who, when we were reading the Francis of Assisi book, the G.K. Chesterton, was that it? Or was it Thomas Aquinas? Yeah, it was. Anyway, they had done a class on that, and I loved their dynamic together so much that I saw this and went, oh, no brainer. So I listened, but I listened to it all while I was still reading Inferno. And that's what really ingrained in me this idea that you have to read the whole thing because they're the ones who keep saying it over and over and over.
Yeah. 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 I remember in this one, and I didn't have time, darn it, to explore it. And this is my first time through this book. And I say the first time knowing that there will be others because this book is now a part of my life.
It's really amazing that
it
way.
It really is. It really is. Canto 6, they talked about.
Yes.
Canto 6 in Inferno and Canto 6 in Purgatorio and Canto 6 in Paradiso all share sort of explanations of the same thing, right?
Or the inconstancy.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, so they made a point of talking about that. And then, you know, that just opens up so many things. It's like, you know, now you want to read it again because how often is he doing that? Do they all match? Is there, you know, what is he doing? And then there is so much here that I know that I do not understand or have not caught.
Or in my case, just went, I can't do all this, like the politics, a lot of it. Yeah. I just went, can't handle it.
Yeah, and there's still a lot of that that I, you know, I completely, you know, there's so many names of people in the current, his contemporaries that, you know, I didn't catch hardly any of that. I don't know that I was in the right frame of mind, and maybe I never will be, but maybe, you know, it might be interesting, you know, in a read in the future just to focus on that stuff. But right now, you know, that's not what I did.
And we had an email from Donna, which thank you, Donna. Hello, we don't get a lot of feedback, but this was amazing feedback. And
really was
she was reading Dante and said, oh, they're doing it too. And listened and so got something from it, which was good. But she said that somewhere she'd read that the format of the comedy altogether somehow mirrors the Divine Liturgy of the Mass. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting commentary there.
Yeah. So I don't know if that ever comes up or if somebody sees where that is. I'd love to read it. Somebody'd have to take my hand and take me through it all the way.
They say, yeah, see this thing right here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
fantastic. Yeah. And there are so many commentaries out there. You know, you just look up Dante on Amazon and it's stunning. A lot of people have spent a lot of time in this.
Yeah, and in fact, my Catholic Women's Book Club is Monday going to discuss Inferno, so I'm going to be going through it again. I'm not going to reread it, but I've got my notes marked, and I'll go through because I've been marking up my Mark Musa books as I went through with little arrows and stars and
That's
everything,
fantastic.
So I can recapture everything, but or hopefully some of it. But somebody there was pointing out a book that I haven't had a chance to look at by Prue Shaw called Reading Dante also. So, and it doesn't take the step-by-step method. It takes, I think she groups it together by friendship, love, politics, and has chapters looking at all those together and comparing. So that also might be handy. You know, I think it's good sometimes when you've read these big books like this to just kind of sit back and then read the commentaries without going through the book.
Yeah.
At least for me, that's how it worked when I read The Lord of the Rings and I went, oh my gosh. And then just sat there and read something. So I wasn't distracted. I could just think about what they were saying and then go back to it.
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. It's Lord of the Rings is one, you know, it gets richer with the next read. Mm-hmm. And I know that this will be like this for me too. Knowing what I know now, to read it again will be really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Each time I get a little something more out of it. Oh, one thing I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there are a few things. But one was he invented the word transhuman.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Is it page 13? Where he's talking. It's very early on because he's like, I was transhuman and or superhuman. Yeah, transhumanized. Dante the Pilgrim becomes transhumanized and enters a state beyond mortal explication, a state that cannot be explained with words.
Hmm.
And I was thinking about how that's our friend Jenny Colvin. Isn't that a kind of a science fiction? And she likes that. It's, you know, like in the future, evolution or science or biology misused or something makes us transhuman.
Yeah, yeah, that is one of the science fiction themes for sure.
I don't.
It's popular like nowadays.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, what are you talking about? Like enhanced by other things, I guess, or beyond human, beyond human.
I believe something which we could talk about later, but dipping into that made me think of transhuman is Paul Atreides in Dune.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
That's right.
Before that word was
coming really right up. Yeah, coming right up. Yeah.
But I was thinking about. It says in Mark Muse's notes, it says he already enjoys, or in his new state, he is to ascend through paradise and gradually acquire understanding of divine love. Thus, he already enjoys a condition far beyond mortal limitations, and in this sense, he has become superhuman. Dante has crossed an essential threshold. What he is about to experience during the rest of his journey must, by its very nature, exceed the intellectual grasp of mortals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also part of the problem with us understanding the book is he, as you said before, he's trying to communicate something that nobody really understands. We can all just guess at and dream about.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that relate to us right here, right now? And that's part of the journey of him meeting all the people who start explaining some things to him.
Yeah. It's amazing that Dante took that on, you know. I think, you know, as someone who has attempted to write, that, you know, when faced with something like this, I would be like, I'm not going to do that. You know, how am I going to write about something that can't be written about? And he clearly knows it, and he says it all the time. But yet he goes ahead and moves forward.
But what if you were cast into exile?
Yeah.
And had to go live in, I don't know, someplace you don't love because it's so different and it's not home. Maine. Nothing wrong with Maine, but it's not where you want to be.
Right.
And your family has to stay where they are, and you're not ever allowed to go back or they'll kill you. And your path is righteous, you feel, and you are trying to work through this in writing. Where does that take you? This is where it took Dante.
Yeah, amazing. Just below transhumanize, which... it says, transhumanize, it cannot be explained per verba, so let this example serve until God's grace grants the experience. Dante says, so it's Beatrice, actually, who says this.
Oh, okay.
You have yourself to blame for burdening your mind with misconceptions that prevent from seeing clearly what you might have seen.
And that does get brought up several times in this book, which is that all of creation echoes back what the Creator has shown them. Hmm. The light that they show is as much as like the rock, the grass, the sky, whatever, the stars.
Mm-hmm.
They, according to their capacity, they reflect God. They show God. We're the ones who can take it and twist it because of free will.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when you wind up.
One, by the way.
Oh, okay. In Inferno, where it's all dark because you've twisted it so much you're not reflecting anything of God.
Right. Wow, that's a struggle, though, isn't it? Yeah, it's it's like what am I carrying around that is preventing me from seeing?
Or even worse.
What am I not seeing?
Well,
you know,
or when you know you're carrying something around, but you're like, I kind of like it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to let this go. Or, mm-hmm. Well, I did it. I'm sorry now. I kind of made that choice at the time. But, yeah, real sorry now. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I also really liked that he, because Dante's trying to see so clearly, you know, he shows us things that we might not like to think about in terms of, I have to think this had to be controversial at the time, and maybe it's mentioned in the notes and I just didn't notice it, my own choice to not read everything thoroughly, but he puts in heaven people have been judged as heretical or wrong and who are redeemed. And two of those people were pagans, one of whom was died before Christ was born. So right, for everybody, Ripheus, if that's how you say his name, who was Trojan. So if you are judging Dante by only reading Inferno, because he's put the virtuous pagans in limbo and he's, you know, got other various people there. Look here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure a lot of people would go, that is not right. Especially in his time.
Yeah, right.
When there was a real clear dividing line. Sorry, if you didn't know Christ, if you were born before he was born and you weren't Jewish, tough.
Yeah, and that does it contradict what he said in Inferno? I'm trying to remember in the pagan part of it. Didn't he say, you know, this is where they go, basically? So what is the difference between the pagan that was in heaven and the pagan that was in
I was just looking for the Inferno. Note on it. This is the part that has the talking eagle that's mad. Okay, this is one of my favorite parts where this halfway through the book, Dante's like, okay, you guys have had like nothing to hang on to here. I'm going to give you this light and laser show that's super cool. And so all these souls look like little shining stars and they all come together and make this big M, and then the M morphs into this eagle and the eagle talks to Dante and says, here are the souls that make up my eye, you know, mm-hmm. And that's where you meet the two pagans. But it says this is one of the head notes. It says the pilgrim is puzzled by the presence of the two pagans, Trajan and Ripheus, and he asks why they are here. The eagle explains that they were Christians when they died through the power of divine grace, and that the workings of predestination are even beyond the understanding of the souls in paradise. And then when he's talking, their lights are flashing like, here we are, here we are. Hey, folks, how you doing? And, well, you know, I just like that visualization of it. But Ripheus of Troy, the notes say that one of several Trojan heroes who fell during the sack of Troy and whom Virgil points out as foremost in justice and zealous for the right, the presence of this relatively obscure pagan in paradise is a further proof of the incomprehensible nature of divine justice. And somewhere I had read that it was saying that basically he had accepted God's okay, it says, God with grace on grace opened his eyes. And the note says, God bestowed special grace on Ripheus, enabling him by means of implicit faith comparable to that which God had given those who were harrowed from hell to believe in Christ before his coming. For this point of doctrine concerning two kinds of grace, operating and cooperating grace, grace on grace, see Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologica. So, not happening in this side of the microphone, but it was that idea that the Catholic Church has in the Catechism, which is that even if you were, I don't know, Native American and nobody ever got here to tell you the gospel, does that mean if you died, you go to hell? Because that's something that we're often accused of believing. And it's like, no, Christ is everywhere. He is in nature. He's, you know, helped create the world. You can know him in other ways according to your own beliefs and the light that God gives you, because it's always grace that we cooperate with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I loved this example so much because I thought, yeah, in 1300, we've got this guy going, you can't judge this. And so again, we have at the beginning of Inferno, you have Virgil and the other pagans, good pagans. Then at the beginning of Purgatory, you have, is it Cato who welcomes them?
Right. Yeah.
And he's a pagan. Mm-hmm. And now you have Riphaeus, who's, mm-hmm. you know, here are the three stages. So he's kind of got an answer for everything if you stick with it long enough or if you care enough to at least trace that part through. Because the parts you mentioned about the inconstancy, you have Francesca and Paolo who eagerly leapt toward infidelity. You have the soul in purgatory who just says a couple words about, you know, my husband killed me and please pray for my soul. We don't know about her. And then you have on the moon, is it Pia? The woman who had been in the convent and was taken out by her family in order to marry somebody. Mm-hmm, and Dante's going, well, wait, they made her do it. How could she be forced? And they're like, well, it depends on how much internally you go along with this. You know?
Right,
you
right.
Resist all the way because there's somebody else there who kind of had a similar situation. And they're like, but she resisted the whole time internally and kept devoted to God in that way. This other one kind of went, well, okay. You made me.
Right.
So you've got all the examples, but you have to be patient enough to work through it.
Right. Yeah, which is another argument for reading all three, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he's not finished in Inferno. He's not done. Yeah. He's got more to say.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So how would you like St. Peter to ask you some questions?
No, thank you.
Hey, I got some questions for you. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Faith, hope, and love. Mm-hmm. The big three are putting you to the question.
Yeah.
I don't know my catechism.
Yeah, good stuff.
Did that make you think of RCIA?
A little bit.
The classes.
A little bit, and how unworthy I am to teach them. Yeah. So, amazing.
Well, and I guess I know that in the early times in the U.S., you know, there's the Baltimore Catechism, which is Q&A. You had to memorize the answers to these sorts of questions. And when you were brought into the church, I think the bishop or whoever would ask people in the classes or in the incoming group these questions, these kinds of questions. You had to know the answer.
Wow.
Just kind of a spot check, you know.
I had bishops do similar things.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it depends on the size of the group and stuff, but usually, you know, they're given a homily and all of the candidates are there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, often, well, I've been doing this through a couple of bishops and we're waiting for another one.
Oh.
One in Idaho and then one here. But, yeah, one of them would just put someone on the spot with something very simple. You know, that had something to do with his homily. Trying to have a conversation rather than a homily, and interesting results. You know, usually he seemed to have a gift on who to ask, you know.
I could just see you in the background.
He wasn't like trying to find the most introvertist, the biggest introvert he could find that would just wither.
Holy Spirit helping him out on that one. This person, exactly. this person.
Yeah, so he could say exactly and go on with his homily and, you know, make everybody feel good. He was really effective.
Hmm.
But you're saying that was like a formal thing where a bishop would come and ask certain questions?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, and also that's, you know, it's not like where you've got Dallas where every church at the Easter Vigil, and we have plenty, are all doing it. So you can't have the bishop.
Yeah, you know what? And what I'm talking about is not new converts. Sorry, I was talking about confirmation candidates.
Oh.
Yeah, where the bishop is present. Yeah, sorry, I am giving the
so where
two different things here. RCIA.
Yeah, where it's Catholics who maybe they were raised Catholic, but they never just entered the church is what you're saying?
Yeah, or? Well, just, yeah, confirmation would be teenagers plus adults that have never gone through confirmation.
Got it.
RCIA is not done with their entrance into the church is usually the bishop isn't present.
Right. You're right.
Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Ideally, it would be, but
right, exactly.
Stage, you can't do that.
Yeah,
I mean, in a lot of places like this, anyway, in the U.S.
Yeah. We'd need more bishops. Everybody has their own.
That's right.
Yeah.
But the priest is, you know, designated in that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the Easter Vigil is so long, no one can stop and do that. I mean, you could, I suppose, but
yeah,
I don't think it used to be that long. My mother-in-law used to say that it was just a mass.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have all the extra stuff that they have, which is all great. I love that extra stuff. But, yeah, you know, that, and when you have like 70 people coming in, mm-hmm, you can't do it.
Absolutely not. Yep. It's tough. Yep.
So, was there anything else that really struck you?
I think I brought up the stuff that was really important to me, that really hit me. But there is just so much here. I'm just looking through some of my highlights. You know, there's so many points of that are teaching moments, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like his answer on the faith.
Yeah.
Which is the common, you know, faith is the substance of those hoped for things, an argument for things we have not seen. And I take this to be its quiddity, which is a word that I've added. Or not, I mean, I've added to my vocabulary because I got to use it. The inherent nature or essence of someone or something. But I don't know what word Dante used, but that was Mark Musa's translation.
I would say that what's interesting, when you get some other translations, like the Isolan one, one page has the Italian opposite the English.
Mm.
So if you cared enough, you would be able to track down the word.
Yeah. Yeah.
And or at least the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And see what a translation was for a particular word. I know it was interesting. I don't know if I've mentioned it here, but Desert Island Discs, you know, the BBC show. Where people will say, here's the 8 songs I would take with me if I was cast away on a desert island. And one of them was Randy Newman that we listened to. And you get to ask for one luxury item and one book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it was Michael Palin who wanted a really good pillow. It's like, oh, good choice.
That's a good idea.
But the book that, and they said, you've already got the Bible and Shakespeare. Let's just get that out of the way. And so what Randy Newman asked for was Dante, but with the Italian on one side and the English on the other. Mm-hmm. He said, I know just enough basic Italian that this way I could reread this book and I could also learn Italian better. I was so impressed.
Nice. That's cool. That's cool. I found a highlight that I really liked.
Yeah.
No Mr. or Miss Know-It-All should think when they see one man steal and one give alms that they are seeing them through God's own eyes.
Oh.
For one may yet rise up, the other fall.
Where is that?
Canto 12. Let's see. XIV is 14. 13. Canto 13 at the very end.
Okay. XIII.
The very last. Yeah. The very last one. XIV is the one that's next.
Oh, okay. Like, so, just checking.
Yeah, I've got the Kindle version here, so
okay.
It's hard for me to see which canto I'm in.
Hard for me to write on my Kindle, so I leave it out. Because
yeah.
I'm just...
But that's what I need. I need to go find a nice copy of this, and then that I can write in.
Yeah, and this is the translation we're using for the book club, and Half-Price Books had, you know, a lot of copies, evidently.
And that was the what was the name again of the translator? The version that you're doing?
Mark Musa?
Oh, the same one. Oh, okay.
Yeah, they were like, which translation? I went, I'm not going through this again. Let's just use Mark Musa. And everybody went, okay.
All right, then.
Like, you can pick your own for if you want. But
that's right.
Because someone said, I already have this one. I was like, I don't think it really matters, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you want. But if you're buying a new one, just get this one and then you could go from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, wow. Okay. Cause I'm, that might have to go into my quote journal.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Cause that's the thing of, we can't see everything, and you do have to judge people you know, it's wrong to steal, but there's context for everything, which is why we have a judicial system and all the other stuff. And we also don't know intention and their whole history, like going forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
God will work with each of those people.
Right. Intention is everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I was really surprised by, and I didn't remember this from before, and I was reading and I went, oh, did I just read what I thought I read? Where he says, then as the tower clock calls us to come at the hour when God's bride is roused from the bed to woo with matin song, matin meaning morning, her bridegroom's love, with one part pulling, thrusting in the other, chiming, ting, ting, music so sweet, the soul ready for love swells with anticipation. So I was witness to that glorious wheel moving and playing voice on voice in concord with sweetness, harmony unknown, save there where joy becomes one with eternity. And I was like, wait, did I just read what I, swelling with anticipation, bridegrooms, and, you know, I was like, ah, seems a bit sexual to me. And they were in Venus, I believe, so. And I just hadn't noticed it. And it says, the notes say, you know, when you're thinking about bride and bridegroom, that's the church and Christ. And he's using a clock on one level. And like, you know, the souls are the workings of a great clock. But then he says, at the same time, mention of the bride and bridegroom, along with the terms used to suggest the physical workings of the clock, carries strongly erotic overtones. The pulling and thrusting movements, as well as the swell of anticipation, are obviously sensual and thereby create surprising interplay within the metaphor. I'm like, no kidding. But then he points out, he says, you know, the light of Solomon, the fifth and most beautiful of all light, which was earlier, prepares us for a sensual ending. And so you think of the Song of Solomon, which is in the Old Testament, and you think also of like saints like Therese of Lisieux, no, not Therese of Lisieux, Saint Teresa of Avila, and that very famous statue of her where she looks ecstatic. It's when God's shoving, or the angel, can't remember which one, is pushing the golden arrow into her heart spiritually. Mm-hmm. And she looks, it could be taken as a sexual moment from the look on her face, and kind of goes back to all the metaphors and examples that are used of the closeness and joy that we achieve when we have that moment with God, and you just can't express it, so you use everything.
Right.
And it did make me stop and kind of dwell on that kind of closeness, that kind of giving of yourself and receiving. And it was just kind of, it turned from shock into kind of this real thoughtful moment for me.
Yeah. Interesting.
So.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, trying to use all the tools at your disposal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a nice way to think about that.
Yeah.
Explaining the unexplainable.
Well, and the thing I would say that we were mentioning this to each other a little earlier is I was surprised the first time I read this. I was like, where's Jesus in all this, you know? And you get to him at the very end, you get to God. But the whole way through the entire comedy, the community is helping you along.
Right, right.
You know, people are sending messengers at the beginning to get Dante started on the journey. They give him a guide. The guides get passed off, but on the way, everybody who's talking to him and asking him questions and everything they're moving him toward God.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes back again to community, for better or worse.
Yeah, yeah. And that's neat. I think, you know, earlier used the words, you know, hands passing, you know, from person to person. And that made me think of the clergy who have had hands put on them all the way back to Jesus.
Oh,
an endless line of people also helping us along the way.
Yeah, because, yeah, it's, and you're good about remembering that, and I'm always grateful for it because, you know, you forget Pope Francis, hands were put on him that went all the way back from when he was a priest, my priest, your priest, the deacons.
Mm-hmm.
That's an endless line of physical hands back to Peter, back to Jesus.
Right.
In the upper room and on the beach. Yeah, wow. It's historical as well as spiritual, which is, I guess, Dante's blending of all that.
Right, right. Maybe the most important thing that he gave me in this book. Yeah, at this point, in this reading, anyway. Right?
Well, that's the foundation on which to build.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's just been fantastic to have read this. So again, thanks for doing this with me. I know we kind of both picked it, but I'm so happy to have read this. It was incredibly worthwhile. Like I say, this is a part of my life now. It's one of those books you can tell that this is going to be with me now. Need a good edition on my shelf in the pool room.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, and a decent other commentary to just kind of, it just gives you more to work with.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like a good teacher, those hands along the way.
Right.
But that's like the Lord of the Rings where, you know, I put it aside and then I feel myself being drawn back to it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's time again to read it, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
And this is the same.
And that's what I tend to do with books like that. I like to find a nice copy. And I did that with Lord of the Rings since we did it on the podcast too. And I got a really nice copy.
Did you get the leather copy?
I did. It's I don't know if it's leather. It's fake leather. I'm turning around. It's behind me, but it's kind of a gray. I just like it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a gray, sort of a leathery cover. Yeah, I'm thinking to do that with books. I know this is off the subject, but not buying a lot of books anymore. I tend to buy fewer, but really nice ones. That's kind of the mode I'm in.
Yeah. That's a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I had started to buy fewer books and just say, well, the library will have this and the library will have that. And then chose Dune for the next book that we'll read. And I said, well, I better get that so I can start it as soon as we're done with this. It's long. I've read it, but it's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
And Dallas Library, huge library system. They have 3 copies of Dune, and all of them are checked out with 1 or 2 holds on them.
Wow.
And I don't know if it was assigned for a class or if this is just how popular the book is. But I was like, I don't think I can wait for all these people to take their 3 weeks and then the next people to take their 3 weeks and then I get it. So luckily, Hannah had my old copy.
When
I was purging, she took it and I went, could I borrow that back? So
that's nice.
That's when I was like, well, after this reading, I may have to see if I have my own copy. I don't know.
Cool. That's cool. Is it a paperback?
Yeah, it's just a 25th anniversary edition that I got a super long time ago. And I was like, I don't get it from the library.
Till very my cool.
Thinking was flawed.
I love it. Well, good. Okay. Wow. So we're leaving Dante.
Yeah, we made it to heaven.
We did.
Thank goodness. I was worried.
Lucky us.
Yep.
Yeah.
But once I hit the eagle,
mm-hmm.
it was all fine. It was up to the eagle. I was really struggling.
Gotcha. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next up is a movie. The Great Escape. I'm excited. Yep.
Such a great movie.
Yep, it really is.
Talk about Community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Good point.
And then,
of course, Dune after that. We were just talking about that. So,
mm-hmm.
So Dune, 2 episodes away. And then we're in September already. Wow.
Start reading now.
Mm-hmm.
And
what
I will
a good
say
book it is, though. I hope people like it who haven't read it. But if you're not a science fiction reader, you know, don't let that worry you. This is science fiction that people that don't like science fiction like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really relatable which is funny to say for a book that has all these concepts that are not relatable. But, and I've been listening to Mythgard Academy, that they, Corey Olson, did, I don't know how many episodes, 8, 9, 10 episodes that are all like 2 hours long. So you have to really care. But it's the way he did Dracula and the way he did The Lord of the Rings and all this, where he just loves getting into the book. And it's been kind of enlightening.
That's good. So,
yeah.
And he's talking about Dune, you said, right?
Oh, yeah, that's Dune.
Yeah, and that was a coincidence. So cool.
Well, it's not current. I mean, it's from a year or two ago.
Oh, okay. So he's done talking about Dune.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And how many lectures was it?
8, 9, 10. I can't remember.
Okay.
Well, wow. Really interesting. You know, they brought up things that I wouldn't have thought of before. And I don't know. You know, if you're interested, if you've read it before, definitely he's worth listening to.
Yeah, cool.
I need help with things like that.
Sounds good. Well, good. All right. Well, thank you again for this experience. It's been great.
Thank you. It's been the best reading of Dante I've ever had because I knew we were going to talk about it, and you had some really great insights.
Oh, so. as did you. You had a lot of stuff. It's really, really neat. A lot of fun.
Thanks for being my Virgil.
That's funny. I was going to say thanks for being my Beatrice, but they had a very special relationship.
No, please don't. Please. That's not right. I am no Beatrice, that's for sure.
Oh, too funny. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thanks. All right. See you soon.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.